Shrink Wrap Radio number 305, The Dangers of Diagnosing Children as Bipolar, with Stuart Kaplan, MD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Stuart L. Kaplan, MD, and we'll be discussing his book, Your Child Does Not Have Bipolar Disorder. According to Stuart L. Kaplan, MD, there are six things you should know about him. He's a Distinguished Life Fellow of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry at Penn State College of Medicine. He was awarded the Outstanding Mental Health Professional of the Year by the National Alliance of the Mentally Ill, St. Louis chapter, in 1998. He served as the Director of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at three major institutions, two of which were university medical schools. He's board certified in child psychiatry and adult psychiatry and served as an examiner for the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology 14 times. And finally, Dr. Kaplan has authored over 100 scientific papers, book chapters, abstracts, and national and international scientific presentations. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Stuart Kaplan, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm happy to finally have you on the show. I know you've been waiting in my queue for some time, and then I missed one of our appointments because I went away on vacation and forgot that I had lined it up. So I thank you for your patience.
Well, of course. Yeah, I'm delighted to be on. It's not necessary to apologize at all. I'm just happy that to be considered.
Well, before we get into your book, let me ask you, how did you get into becoming a child and adolescent psychiatrist? I know it's a role that you've been in for quite a while. Is this something you always knew you wanted to be, or what?
Yes, actually it is. It goes back to my adolescence, actually, when I was a camp counselor for a couple of years at overnight camp, and I just found myself really so interested in the children that I was taking care of, and trying to be helpful to them, and they would talk to me at times at great length about worries that they had and concerns that they had, and I was just quite taken and fascinated by the notion of actually being able to help these kids and to provide them some comfort solace just by talking to them. And similarly, I began to read a fair amount about psychology and psychoanalysis as an adolescent, and I was just really entranced by various writings about it. I just thought it was fascinating. So the idea that I could might one day become an actual psychiatrist was something that just had incredible appeal for me.
Well, that's great.
It's something I've stuck with throughout my life. Yeah,
yeah, that's great. You know, that's something that we have in common is that camp counselor experience when I was.
Right.
Yeah, when I was a.
Go ahead, tell me about it.
Yeah, when I was a graduate student at the University of Michigan, they had a camp for emotionally disturbed kids, our boys, called the Fresh Air Camp, and in all places, it was located in Hell, Michigan.
Yeah, aptly named. I'm
it
sure.
was very aptly named, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Right. So your book is very provocatively titled, Your Child Does Not Have Bipolar Disorder. And the subtitle goes on to say how bad science and good public relations created the diagnosis. Now, that's a pretty strong accusation. Are you saying that children are never bipolar?
Well, I'll tell you, I stand by the title. I chose that title very deliberately. A lot of sort of academicians have danced around the idea that that bipolar disorder, has a dubious sort of existence. But but very few have come out and baldly stated what is a painful, obvious truth, as far as I'm concerned, and as well as far as many other senior leaders in the field at this time. I think the disorder, you know, as soon as you say that something in childhood, I think it's largely non-existent. I hedge a little bit by saying largely, because as soon as you say that something doesn't exist, it's inevitable that somebody is going to find a case of it and say, oh, well, here is a child who has bipolar disorder, therefore everything Kaplan said is wrong. And, you know, so I want to avoid that, you know. I don't want to take a position that's, you know, that's highly improbable, and that, you know, this book, Black Swans, you know, as soon as you say there's no black swans, it turns out there's flocks of them in Australia and that sort of thing. So I'm sure there's a few cases around, but they're extremely rare. And,
right.
You know, very, very rare. And if people who say that disorder exists, you know, the burden of proof is on them. And so I really, go ahead. You know, 12 and under in children, 12 and under, prepubertal children, it's largely non-existence.
Okay.
It does become a disorder in adolescence. Of course, it does appear during mid to late adolescence.
Yeah, we'll get into adolescence in a bit.
Yeah, sure.
But your position is that it's very rare, and yet, as over a course of a very relatively few years, now it's being, according to your book, something like 800,000 cases reported of child bipolar, and yet there's no scientific evidence for it, you say. Do I have that right?
Well, the people who say that it exists and believe in it and who study it, of course, believe strongly that there is scientific evidence for it. But when you examine the scientific evidence with a critical eye, you know, the evidence that's put forward is easily countered, you know, and easily done away with. The figure most often quoted, the most solid number in terms of the increase in the disorder, is based on an article from Marino, which is in 1994-95 to 2002-2003, there was a 4,000% increase in the disorder. So it just soared dramatically. And this was, there was little or no scientific basis for this, and it was largely a cultural phenomenon. It was not really that there was some scientific discovery, something was seen someplace under a microscope or in a test tube, or you know, there was really, really little scientific evidence for it. But culturally, it was a firestorm, and it just took off and managed to be perpetuated and disseminated.
You mentioned a name there that I didn't quite catch.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's Moreno, M-O-R-N-E-O. And he wrote an article along with his co-authors in the Archives of General Psychiatry. I think that was around 2007.
Oh, okay.
And that article really was the first major public scientific obstacle or challenge to the diagnosis of bipolar disorder in children. That really was the first blow to the epidemic, I would say, the first scientific blow to the epidemic.
Now, you're not denying that a lot of kids do display some rather severe behavioral disorders, right?
Oh, of course not. Of course not. I'm a child psychiatrist. I see very difficult, challenging kids, you know, all day long in a variety of different settings. And kids, of course, children and adolescents can be extremely difficult.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, in today's paper, I was reading an article about people are concerned that the police are being called into schools more and more to deal with what would in the past have been just considered behavioral problems of one sort or another. And kids are being put in handcuffs. So we can't deny that there's some problems out there.
Yeah, but, you know, I didn't see the article, but I had a case myself this past week where the mother reported it, or the child who's my patient, the police came to the school and they put the kid in handcuffs. And, I think many disputes that in the past would have been settled by, you know, more judicious, wise principal and sort of some agreement between parents about how to handle a situation are much too rapidly being turned over to the police. Personally, I mean, certainly that was a case in my patient. You know, it was ridiculous. And now the poor child has to go to court and he had to spend a few hours in a prison cell at the police station and everything.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
There was really no there was no reason for it.
How old a kid was this?
Yeah, he's around 9 years old.
Wow.
You know, not an evil, malevolent child, or even disruptive in any particular way. He just happened to get in a little, you know, he got in a fight, actually out in front of the school, and, you know, I don't know whose fault it was or whatever, but not the sort of thing that would ordinarily lead you to expect a child to be put in handcuffs.
Right.
So it's a double-edged sword. I'm sure there are some kids who are so difficult to handle that the police have to be called, but it should only be done, should not be the first thing that happens, obviously.
So if it's a case of misdiagnosis that we have all these kids under 12 that are being diagnosed as bipolar and put on meds and so on, what are the diagnoses that would be more appropriate?
I think that's a very good question. My answer that I put forth in my book and strongly continue to believe in is that most of these children have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, which I'm sure your listeners are well acquainted with, a very common disorder in childhood, and also one that's very amenable to treatment. It's very well understood. And they have ADHD, plus they have a disorder in the DSM-4 called oppositional defiant disorder, which is where you tell a child to do something, and they refuse to do it, and whatever you ask them to do, they say no, and, you know, they're very prone to disagree with you about anything, and they're irritable and unhappy and easily provoked to anger and aggression. And most of these children, from my perspective, seem to have both ADHD and oppositional defiant disorder.
Isn't there some controversy about both of those diagnoses, though?
Well, sure, of course, yeah. There's a lot of controversy about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in the sense of, people feel it's overdiagnosed. They also object to the treatment, which is stimulant medications most often, although it can, you know, mild cases can be treated psychologically. But, from my perspective, and also from the science, the literature, is that ADHD is not overdiagnosed. I mean, there's been several studies where various studies have been done where it's either diagnosed at a reasonable level, or actually an important study by NIMH found, that it was often underdiagnosed. And for 20 or 30 years at least, or longer, you know, there's often alarmist stories in the paper about freight trains trundling through the night, you know, with railroad cars loaded up to the top with stimulant medications and so forth. And I think a lot of these are, there's just overreactions, scare kind of stories, alarmist sort of stories. The truth is that ADHD and stimulant medications have been studied for decades, since the 1930s, and it's one of the most effective, safest treatments in medicine. And that's another reason that I like it, because when I see ADHD, you know, I know that there's an excellent chance I can be very helpful and in a very safe way. And change a child and his behavior dramatically, safely in a brief period of time. If you have a child who's hyperactive, inattentive, running around, not listening, you give him an adequate dose of stimulant medication, you know, in 1 hour he's a different kid, which is really dramatic, you know. It's really, you don't see that every day in medicine, you know. Right. So it's pretty powerful, you know, and I'm happy to do that for them.
Yeah, my wife is a teacher, and I was talking to her about this upcoming interview, and she said that she's seen the kind of dramatic changes that you're talking about, that she talked about the one child that she has who was just hell on wheels and had such difficulties in the classroom that he asked to be put in the closet, that he just didn't want to have any contact with anybody. And as soon as he gets on his medication, he just becomes the sweetest kid and able to interact with others in the classroom and able to engage in learning and so on. So
that's great. I'm glad you could say that. That's very nice. You know, because I believe in, and the other side is that there's a sizable portion of the public. I don't know how large it is, but it's pretty big, who hates the diagnosis, who hates the medicine, and is just shrill about, denouncing the medicine, over-dramatizing any possible side effects. And it makes my job as a doctor trying to persuade parents, most of whom are very reluctant, actually, to try these medications. And a lot of them feel, you know, really guilty and crestfallen and become tearful when, confronted almost with the need of their child for the medication. And they become, they really become very distraught about it. So there's a danger to all the shrill denunciation of the medicine and so forth.
Well, I've actually interviewed the I'm blocking on his name, the famous Dr. Peter something.
Bregan, that's it.
Right, who really inveighs against that in particular, and against psychiatric medication generally. And certainly he's been very influential in.
Yeah.
So that's part of what you're up against, I guess, huh?
Yes. And it's very important. I think this anti-psychiatry, anti-medication movement is just increasing in numbers, becoming more strident and more influential. Even the New York Times, they constantly write articles which suggests that children with ADHD are better off not taking medicine, and there are much better ways to handle the problem and so forth. So, there's a large public venue for complaining about these medicines. But I also want to take the other side. The medicine can have side effects. Every time you give a stimulant, you don't always hit a home run with it. And, but a good doctor will help with the side effects. If the medicine isn't working, they'll switch to a different stimulant medication and so forth and so on. So it's not like giving aspirin for a headache. I mean, it does require a little finesse and care and so forth to make sure you get the best response from the medicine.
Well, ADHD, like bipolar, which we started to talk about and which we will come back to, It seems to be sort of wildly on the increase, too, in terms of the amount of diagnoses. And even though you say studies have shown that it's not overdiagnosed, so if it's not being overdiagnosed, do you have any ideas about why it seems to be on the increase?
Yes. I do, as a matter of fact. It used to be thought that ADHD was a diagnosis that was limited to childhood. And around with the onset of adolescence, at 12 or 13, you sort of lost your ADHD. And that was kind of the end of it. Then later on, more recently, we saw, well, half of the children lose their ADHD and the other half continue on through adolescence. Now I think it is much better and much more correctly appreciated that ADHD is really found frequently in adolescence. It often does not go away with the onset of adolescence. And furthermore, there's a very substantial number of adults who have ADHD who can and should and will benefit greatly from getting it treated. And I think that's a very, correct and important kind of observation. And for those of us who treat adults with ADHD, I mean, it's extremely gratifying. These people are, you know, just being at work is hell for them. They have to fight all day to try and sit still. They really have trouble concentrating. And they often select a career based on their ADHD. They work in construction or something where they can move around a lot because, you know, they correctly understand that they can't take a job where they're going to have to sit behind a desk and, you know, engage in some fairly tedious kind of work.
Do you think there's anything, any kind of an environmental cause that's leading to an increase of this kind of problem, either by environmental, I mean either the social environment or the physical environment?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know the answer. I mean, you know, the most widely understood explanation for ADHD is that it's genetic. But there could be other causes for ADHD. Lead poisoning. There's so many toxins in the environment. You know, who knows what we're exposed to these days in terms of foods and air pollution and so forth. So there can be other causes, and certainly there are other, anxiety is associated with short attention span and overactivity. It's very hard to concentrate if you're depressed, and certainly there's a lot of conflict and uncertainty and so forth in the home environment. Children are going to have trouble concentrating. Also, the prenatal environment is very important. Fetal alcohol syndrome, people who drink during pregnancy and children often have terrible ADHD as well as a number of other neurological problems. And then children who are neglected and abused, you know, during their preschool years and infancy, and children who are understimulated during infancy and the preschool years can also present, you know, can have a lot of trouble sitting still and run around all the time and so forth. So there are a lot of things that can cause the appearance of it. But without those obvious insults, it's usually felt to be genetic.
Okay, well, coming back to childhood bipolar, one of the things that you talk about are the dangers of misdiagnosis. So tell us a little bit about, what's the downside of labeling a kid as bipolar when in fact that's not what's going on?
Well, there are many dangers. One is you allude to, in terms of labeling, when a child is given a diagnosis of bipolar disorder, it changes the way everybody looks at the child, and it changes the way the child looks at himself. He begins to think of himself differently. He has bipolar disorder. And this is any diagnosis is a prophecy. There's a prognosis.
Mm-hmm.
about how you're going to do. So if somebody says, "Yo, you have bipolar disorder," to, you know, a little kid, you're making a prophecy about this kid. You know that, oh, he's going to have mood swings, and he's going to have elation, and he's going to have depression, and maybe he'll be a great poet, a great musician, or something like that. But he's certainly going to have not an easy life, and he has a genetic disorder. Because bipolar is clearly a genetic disorder, and so the way the child begins to think about himself is very different. And the people who believe in bipolar disorder, is a whole series of books that for parents to read to their young children, you know, say tuck them in at night or something, that is explains to the young child, 3 and 4 year old, about how they have bipolar disorder. And I personally find those books heartbreaking to read, because it's clear to me that the children don't have bipolar disorder, and they're being given this false identity.
Is it worse? Is it more harmful than telling them that they have ADHD?
Oh, I think so. I think so. Definitely, yeah. You know, listen, first of all, bipolar disorder is really a major Lee psychopathology. I mean, you know, he is psychiatrically hospitalized, not uncommonly. You have to take medicines your whole life, some of which may work, many of which don't work. You know, it's a much more grim prognostic outcome. It follows you your whole life, and it often leads to death. From suicide during the depressive aspect. Whereas ADHD, it's not such a bad thing. You know, you take your stimulant medication and you do fine and you feel much better immediately. So yes, I would say it's very different. And not only that, what the people are telling the children is not true. Think of it. You know, I think one day, the time is not far off, where you're going to have a child who's been told he's bipolar all of his life. You know, he's going to hit his early adulthood, and he's going to write a great, you know, make a great movie about this, or write a great novel or something, because it's really an embittering kind of ironic thing to be told by the authorities, the intellectual, trusted authorities of your childhood, that you have something that you really don't have, and to be treated that way.
Yeah,
I think it's there's a huge difference. When you're told you have ADHD, at least, you know, presumably most of the time that's a correct diagnosis.
The other danger that you point out in your book of misdiagnosis of bipolar is that they are given the wrong medications and the wrong kind of treatment.
Right. And I'm sort of warming up to that.
Okay.
You know, I just didn't want to miss the psychological aspect of giving the wrong diagnosis, because I do think that's important. But yes, there's at least two aspects to giving the wrong medications. One, they're often given medications that have been developed and tested and assessed for adults who actually have bipolar disorder. And these medications include lithium and also a number of anti-seizure medications, which really have an array of very serious side effects. And actually, in clinical tests or research studies, you know, these medicines really don't work in these children, period.
Okay.
So they're exposed to terrible risks and they get little benefit. And that's, you know, not a good thing. Now, there's another side to this as well. Since anybody who studies bipolar disorder in children or adolescents recognizes and acknowledges that 70 to 90% of them have ADHD, along with their bipolar disorder. But the people who've advocated for this diagnosis have taken a position that these children should not be given stimulant medications, the one medication that can help them. So therefore, these kids are really doubly disadvantaged. They're getting the wrong medication, and they're often forbidden to have the medication that can help them. So they're really greatly disadvantaged. Now, there is one medication that's used in bipolar disorder, children and adolescents, one class of medicines that has been shown to be effective, and that's antipsychotic medications like Seroquel, Risperidone, Abilify. You know, and those are helpful to these kids, but they are helpful, you know, for any aggressive child. These medications would be helpful. There's nothing specific about this class of medications for bipolar disorder.
Now, part of your argument in the book for the fact that kids are misdiagnosed as mm-hmm. bipolar is you appeal to the DSM-IV, the Diagnostic and
right.
Statistical Manual
right.
of the American
right.
Psychiatric right. Association, version 4. And for adult bipolar mania, there has to have been a prior manic episode. And you talk in some detail about hypomania. And mania, and very eloquently and colorfully.
Thank you. good. It's okay to promote that. Good.
Yeah. Well, I could identify particularly with the hypomanic part because.
Sure.
I think I have. Interestingly, that we're talking about this now. I think I have some bipolar in my genetic history, and I was prescribed Valium years ago for a stomach ailment of all things. And over time, I found that Valium seemed to do something that relaxed some of my moral considerations and put
mm-hmm.
me into kind
sure.
of a hypomanic episode that nobody had ever warned me about and that I couldn't see, but my wife was concerned about and my friend was concerned about. And so I could really identify with your description of hypomania. Take us through that.
Yeah, well, you know, stuff like Valium and everything, it is disinhibiting. It relaxes your inhibition. So, you know, you might, you know, you could get in trouble that way.
It happened over, I don't remember, it's a long time ago, but it seems to me like it didn't happen right away. It was over a period of weeks or months.
Sure. Well, you know, a little hypomania is not such a bad thing as far as I'm concerned. I mean, a lot of people, you know, at times get a little hypomanic, like if you're facing writing deadlines or you really have to get busy and do a lot of stuff that might seem overwhelming at times. And if you can do that, if you can access a part of your personality, which, you know, can be very productive and very ambitious. I mean, you know, to be able to sit down and write a book, to really think you're going to be able to do that, you know, it's a little nutty, you know. So you have to have some of that ambition available to you, you know. And I think what I'm saying is important because in children and adolescents, you know, a lot of times they're sort of first grapplings with ambition or hopes for the future or whatever can easily be misunderstood as hypomania. And I think that's terrible. Often the psychiatrists who believe in bipolar, they give examples like a child who wasn't very good at a musical instrument, he was practicing the guitar, but he hoped he would, you know, be like a famous Segovia or something. He'd be a great player, but he couldn't, you know, actually, if you listen to him, he really wasn't that good. But, you know, so what? You know, all of us who've played musical instruments in childhood thought we really sounded cool, but sooner or later we find out, you know, we weren't so good, most of us, and we go on to other things. You know, I think it's just part of being a child. And,
let me just insert something that I just realized, which is, it might be that not all of our listeners would understand that the modifier hypo means means sort of less, and hyper means more. So when we say hypomania, we're talking about slightly manic, not a full blown manic attack, which is very extreme and very disruptive, and can go into what might be called hyper. mania, which would be even worse. So hypomania is a mild kind of moving in the direction of mania.
Right. It's a milder form, and it can be very pleasant. You know, if you really have hypomania, you get very busy, friendly, active, often very productive, become very engaging. You find yourself, the world seems like a brighter place. Mm-hmm. You find yourself talking to more people. You have more interesting ideas. And, you know, it's not uncommon to sort of have more sexual contacts when you're hypomanic. And you can feel it's very pleasant and very, for this reason, very few people in a hypomanic state go to see a psychiatrist.
In fact, you point out that, you know, when you talk about adolescent bipolar and hypomania, you point out that it's a lot like being in love, that adolescents tend to be in love a lot and fall in love quite easily. And they have that wonderful high that you get from being in love and the rose-colored glasses that come with it.
Right, exactly. There was a wonderful study I described in the book where I think it was a Dutch psychiatrist did this study where he found a group of adolescents who were in the early stage of romantic love. They were just really smitten with a member of the opposite sex, and he gave them this hypomania questionnaire that's usually given to adults. And the adolescents who were actually in the early stage of romantic love really scored the same as diagnosed adults with hypomania.
And these were normal kids, right?
Absolutely. It's normal. So the point is that it's very important not to misunderstand, you know, the hypomania of adolescence, like falling in love, is psychopathology, because it's not. It's just part of normal adolescence.
So I'm wondering, with the overdiagnosis, the misdiagnosis of bipolar among children, I'm suspicious. Where is Big Pharma in all this? Are they culpable at all?
Oh yes, of course. They're always culpable. You know? Yeah, they loved it. You know, they were licking their chops. I don't think they started it, but they were very accepting of it, and they were happy to promote it. And you know, they sold a lot of medication as a result of it. So they were very supportive of the diagnosis. But to be fair, you know, they didn't start it. I think pediatric bipolar disorder is somewhat unusual in mental health circles. And I think that the National Institute of Mental Health really played a very large part in promoting and disseminating the concept. And
why would they do that?
Well, you know, that's a good question. There are a few things I don't know about pediatric bipolar, not much, but one of them is I really don't know why they did it. I've had several musings about it. Maybe there was an important politician who had a child who seemed to have pediatric bipolar disorder. Maybe there were several very esteemed, influential child psychiatrists who believed strongly in the disorder, and maybe they felt, well, you know, if these eminent child psychiatrists, you know, really believe in it, maybe it would be wise and reasonable to go ahead and promote it. But I don't actually know why. You know, Joseph Groupman, the columnist, distinguished Harvard guy who's a columnist for The New Yorker, wrote a piece about pediatric bipolar disorder around 3 years ago, where he describes a group of parents clutching a book that I absolutely despise called The Bipolar Child by the Papalosis. This is a well-known book, regrettably. It's probably the best-selling book in mental health next to DSM. Wow. It's in its third printing. It sold a couple hundred thousand copies. Unfortunately, it's devoid of factual information. But this book really helped disseminate the diagnosis. I mean, it was a major lever and the public acceptance of the diagnosis, because it was on Oprah in 2020. You know, the authors got on all these major TV shows. So a group of parents were clutching this book, and they went to see the director of the National Institutes of Mental Health, who at the time was Dr. Stephen Hyman. So he explained to Dr. Groopman, the New Yorker writer, well, all these parents came to see me, and they were clutching this book, and they were demanding that, you know, that we do some studies of bipolar disorder. So that's another explanation, quote unquote.
Yeah.
But who knows? I don't really know. I think there are probably people around who do know, but, you know, I haven't really heard an explanation yet that I could sign on to, you know.
Well, one of the things that you point out, which in a way is kind of startling, and maybe I knew this at some level, but I'd never seen it stated quite so baldly, is you say there are really no biological markers for any psychiatric disorder.
That's true. That's true. That's absolutely true. And, you know, psychiatry is always desperately trying to find them, and you can't pick up a psychiatry journal, you know, every month that isn't reporting some possible marker, you know, a CAT scan of the brain found this or that or the other. But the truth is there's no biological basis for any site, no known biological basis.
That does open the door for diagnostic fads, and we've seen diagnostic fads, you know, in what's supposed to be a scientific enterprise, but I'm thinking of, you know, maybe you can think of some examples of diagnostic fads. One that comes to mind to me, I think, is multiple personality.
Exactly. That's a classic. Yeah.
Yeah. When I was in graduate school, I was told that I would probably never see one in my life, or maybe one or two.
Right.
And now, I have students coming up to me and almost bragging that there are multiple.
Yeah, right, right. That is really, that's a classic one. And, you know, hysteria is, you know, conversion reaction.
Yeah.
Now, World War One, you know, that's what Freud was interested in. And everybody was, you know, limping around with genetic paralysis of one sort or another, and then it just dropped out. And another, you know, and you're right, we are vulnerable to these fads. And media, this is another point I guess I try and convey in my book, that, you know, when the DSM comes out, when a new diagnosis is put forth, and people go out, psychiatrists, mental health psychologists, and they see it, they say, gosh, you know, I never saw that before, but now that I look at it, I see this patient has it, you know, like social phobia, and so forth and so on, and depression. And, you know, whenever there's a new diagnosis that comes out, most of us see it. And so the explanation is that it's been unrecognized, underappreciated.
Mm-hmm.
But another explanation that is equally compelling, if not more compelling, is that we, meaning our mental health professionals, the various APAs and everything, you know, we create the diagnosis and the culture. And certainly pediatric bipolar disorder is the perfect example. That disorder does not exist. But with all the media, all the hype, you know, these kids were turning up. And not only that, parents were coming in. The parents would absorb this diagnosis from the media and also from various websites and from, you know, books and everything. And they would come in and they would tell you, every symptom of bipolar disorder, you know, that they had learned and insist that their child had it. Yeah, when in fact the child didn't have it. Yeah. So we created the that diagnosis.
This is making me think of medical student syndrome, where when people mm-hmm. are in medical school and they learn about these various diseases, they start monitoring themselves for it, and they become convinced, you know, hey, I've got this. And certainly those of us who go to graduate school to become psychotherapists, we take abnormal psychology at some point and begin to fret and experience in ourselves, you know, all the signs of all the various diagnostic categories. So there's a way in which culturally, maybe we all kind of in a way suffer from medical student syndrome.
Right, that's exactly right. This wonderful book, I think it's called Crazy Like Us by a gentleman named Waters. Just a wonderful book. He describes this very vividly. He thinks there's something called the symptom pool, and that we're all a little unhappy and a little disjointed in certain ways and everything, and if things really get bad, we'll look in the symptom pool, you know, for something to attach these feelings to.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of unruly children running around, and pediatric bipolar disorder jumped in the symptom pool, and people took it out, you know.
Yeah. Now, earlier you mentioned parents, and we should talk about parents, because as you have just pointed out, that there are a lot of very concerned parents who've seen this book that you mentioned, and they've heard things about childhood bipolar, and you devote the last chapters of your book to sort of to parents and with advice to parents. So what is your advice to parents of a child who's either been diagnosed as bipolar, who's been diagnosed as bipolar, or they're worried that maybe that's what's going on?
Yeah.
What would you have them do?
Well, I know this is sounds terribly self-serving, and you know, I've tried to think of a way of avoiding saying it, but I'd just be really blunt and candid. I mean, my book, I think, could be very helpful to them. There are about 30 books out there on bipolar disorder on Amazon, and there's mine is the only one for parents that is critical of the disorder.
Mm-hmm. Well,
there's one other one for professionals that is also very critical by Sharna Offman, which is a good book. I think it's called The Bipolar Child or something. Sharna Offman, OLFMAN. But most of the books you're going to read, and most of this, 98% of the books, 98% on the internet, is going to be supportive of the diagnosis. So, you know, I think you want to hear the other side. I think you want to know how to discuss the diagnosis, you know, with the therapist, what questions to ask, how to evaluate the answers, and, you know, be sort of how to be intelligent, critical of what you're hearing. It's not about joining a cult or anything like that. You want to do what's best for your child. And I think to inform yourself about the literature and what's been said, it would be very helpful to parents. It will help you have a better conversation. At the end of the day, you may decide your child's bipolar, you know, but at least it'll be a well-informed decision. The other thing is, I would say you definitely want to see a good child psychiatrist, and you want to see one who believes in DSM, Diagnostic Statistical Manual. In the bipolar child, the Papalosis strongly suggest you find a psychiatrist who doesn't believe in the DSM, which I think is really terrible advice, because the diagnosis, you know, must be made, if it's going to be made correctly, on DSM criteria. And say you want to find yourself a good child psychiatrist, you know, often at university, but not exclusively there, and work with them and come to understand as much as you can about the disorder. But you have to realize that 98% of the media stuff you're going to go to, or 99.9, is going to be in favor of the disorder.
And would part of your advice be to suggest that they also have that professional consider the possibility of ADHD?
Sure, absolutely. And a good professional will, because, you know, again, you know, 70 to 90% of children who are diagnosed with bipolar disorder have ADHD. Another thing that's important to appreciate, I think, for parents is that often there's a person in the family, it might be mother, father, or uncle, or somebody who has bipolar disorder. So even if there is a person in the family who has bipolar disorder, the child is, you know, is only a 1 in 20 chance that the child is going to get bipolar disorder. And even if they do get bipolar disorder, they're not going to get it during childhood. They get it later on, in mid to late adolescence, or early adulthood, or further on. But just because there's a parent who has bipolar disorder doesn't mean that the child has bipolar disorder. They can have lots of problems, and children of parents with bipolar disorder are vulnerable to difficulties, but that doesn't mean they have bipolar disorder.
You know, it occurs to me that we never did really define bipolar disorder.
Yeah, it's
so well known in the culture. I think we're just assuming that everybody knows what we're talking about, but fundamentally, we're talking about extreme manic episodes where a person becomes so agitated during the manic phase that it borders on delusions and hallucinations and just extreme agitation, and then crashes into a crippling kind of depression, and that this recycles over and over again. Would you say that's kind of an accurate thumbnail description?
Yes, yes. I would, but I have a few caveats.
Okay, good.
One, especially, you know, a critical issue is that the person's behavior should be different from what it usually is. It should be distinctly different. See, in children and adolescents who are too aggressive and fighting all the time and irritable all the time, and, you know, that's constant. That's just the way they are. They're that way all of the time. It's not just that they cycle into this, you know. Mm-hmm. They're that way all of the time. So it should be a distinct, something absolutely different than the patient's usual behavior, you know, at least at the time of the onset of the disorder.
Yes.
And it's recognized by other people to be different. Say, oh, you know, everybody says, oh, well, I wonder what's wrong with so-and-so today. He really seems different than usual. You know, people should recognize that it's different. And it doesn't have to be extreme. Sometimes it starts off, you know, much milder and so forth. And not everybody goes on to become psychotic or require hospitalization. It can often be treated as outpatient, and it can often be successfully treated in adults. Given the right medication, the right diagnosis, they can do extremely well and have very productive lives.
Okay, well, as we wind down here, I'm wondering if there's
anything
else that you'd like to add. Is there anything you were kind of planning to say or hoping to say that we didn't get to here?
Well, I think it's important when these issues come up that families work together, okay? And, you know, seeing the psychiatrist and reading all the material about it, and, you know, if there are differences of opinion between mother and father, that's understandable, but they should, at the end of the day, they should come together on the way they're going to manage their child, you know. I often see parents who bitterly disagree, and the father waits in the car while the mother brings the child in to see me and so forth. Those are very difficult situations.
Yes. Well, Dr. Stuart Kaplan, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It was my great pleasure. I really enjoyed talking with you. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Stuart Kaplan. I found him refreshingly different from my stereotype of a psychiatrist. I really must get rid of my prejudicial stereotypes, but they seem to have a way of hanging on. Have you ever noticed that? In yourself, I mean. At any rate, I found him to be pleasantly relaxed and open. In fact, he seemed positively laid back. However, let me assure you, his book comes across quite differently. In his book, he speaks with considerable authority and is a trenchant critic of the childhood bipolar diagnosis, and he offers plenty of research to back up his viewpoint. I also applaud his courage in speaking up against the prevailing tide of diagnosing children with bipolar disorder. I would especially recommend his book for the parents of any child who has been given this diagnosis.
Dr. Dave would never ask you himself, but the show is growing and so are his production expenses. Be a part of our podcast family and make a contribution to keep these informative and entertaining programs coming. The show must go on, and with your support, it can. Just go to the website and click on the green donate button. Long live Shrink Wrap Radio and the listeners that support it.
Thanks, Sherry West. And I'm afraid it's not quite true that I'd never ask for your support myself, because, as you know, I have in the past. But I do appreciate these promos because they let someone else do the asking for me. I do want to thank all of you who've clicked on that big green donate button. And once again, I want to call your attention to the fact that there are now a bunch of new share buttons beneath each episode on the website. So now, if you go to the website, you'll find you can easily email a link to any given episode to your friends, and you'll also see buttons for sharing via your Facebook, Twitter, Google+, or LinkedIn social networks. Thanks again to listener Lisa Chalfoun for that excellent suggestion. And here's yet a new feature on our webpage. At the bottom of the right-hand sidebar, you'll find links you can click on that will take you to our Facebook fan group page, which I know many of you are already among my friends there. And there's also a link to my new Facebook Shrink Wrap Radio page, which I guess is considered a business page. But it's a great place for you to give us lots of likes. Presumably, this will help us to rank higher in the search engines, and we do want everyone seeking psychology-related podcasts to find us. And while you're down there on the bottom of our right-hand sidebar, you'll also find a link to our Yahoo discussion group. It's sort of an email listserv that was set up sometime back by listener Reinhardt. It's got 50 members, but doesn't have a lot of activity currently. And Reinhardt is hoping someone will step forward to be a co-facilitator to breathe more life into the group. There's no single topic. It's up for grabs in terms of what you guys want to discuss. So if you have the time, energy, and interest to co-facilitate, please let either Reinhardt know directly in that Yahoo discussion group, or let me know and I'll pass him the info. You know, we have lots of CE unit possibilities, that is, continuing education unit possibilities on our website for those of you who need or want to earn them. Well, we're just putting the finishing touches on a course on the pros and cons of positive psychology, which will supplement another course that's already up there on positive psychology. So I'll be announcing that and putting the links on the site sometime in the next 2 or 3 weeks. And I'm just announcing it now to whet your appetite. Hey, I would love to meet listeners on the Google Plus video chat hangouts. If you're on Google Plus, please send me an email letting me know, and I'll add you to my Shrink Wrap Radio circle. I've only got one listener in there so far, Brandon Dennis, who is in New Zealand and who's been helping me master the Google Plus environment. And finally, by the way, there is a new transcript available. It's number 294, The Dark Side of Seligman's Comprehensive Soldier Fitness with Stephen Soltz, PhD. Now, that's a really key one, and I know you're going to want to have it for your files. So just go to the site and click on the Transcripts tab, and you'll find it right there.
Hi, this is Dr. Elisha Goldstein, psychologist, workshop leader, and author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
And of course, Dr. Elisha Goldstein will be my return guest on the next episode. More about that in a bit. First, let's listen to a few recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from Susie, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave and Dr. Landau, I really enjoyed this interview, and I thought I would share a synchronicity event I experienced after listening to your show. I was particularly interested in the descriptions of the different goddesses and was thinking to myself, which one am I? Then Arlene mentioned that a lot of women are a mixture of both. This immediately sent shivers down my spine as I had a flashback. Almost 10 years ago to the day, I was backpacking in Greece. In a lot of the tourist shops, they had these Greek goddess dolls, which I fell in love with, but they were pretty expensive and totally impractical to pack. However, after a few days, I broke down. I just couldn't resist them. I remember hemming and hawing over which one I should get, and I just couldn't choose, so I finally ended up buying two, Hera and Aphrodite. This was particularly interesting to me, as recently I have really been struggling with the idea of marriage and children, and have nailed it down to the fact that I have two sides of my personality, one that's very practical and wants to have a family, and the other side that wants to run away and never settle down. I'm sure you're not alone in that, Susie. Aphrodite is currently hanging in my bathroom while Hera is in my childhood bedroom at my parents' house. I think next time I go home, I will bring Hera back and display her with Aphrodite to remind me of both sides of my psyche. What's so striking to me is that my 19-year-old self, while not consciously having this struggle, was obviously aware of this dichotomy. Thanks for a great show and take care, Susie. And Susie, thank you for monitoring our Facebook fan page, as well as sharing this dichotomy with us, which I'm sure other people will be able to identify with. Next, we hear from Helene, who replied to my thanks for her donation, saying briefly, Yay, glad to be a shot in the arm. Have got many gifts from your work. Thank you. Warmly, Helene. And then we hear from Lisa, who also was commenting in the comments area on the Aphrodite complex. And Lisa writes, Very interesting topic. I always enjoy learning more about archetypes, but this time my European thinking or upbringing made it very difficult to separate cliche from archetype, as there's a lot of maybe even dislike of celebrities, let's say German-speaking Europe's intellectual culture. I think Lisa is in Germany, by the way. And because of that specific culture, the last phrase became very long, too. I could relate, though, to the perception of beautiful women in the Ukraine, Russia, etc., as well as the popularity of the, quotes, Western, end quote, beauty accessories. The interview was very stimulating, and I'm looking forward to studying these archetypes in detail. Hollywood, America, those are myths for many people around the world. I especially like the statement of Dr. Landau about integrating or looking inside oneself for what one is desiring or that type of person one wants to be or wants to be with. This is one of the essential findings to me. It's also one that shows the way from being unhappy with oneself towards being happy with oneself. But I must say I still have not completely grasped the concept of the shadow, although I've read quite a bit about it. Dr. Dave, would you mind explaining this a bit? If you think it would also be interesting to other listeners, that would be very nice. Very interesting how the archetypes play so differently in different cultures. The association of blonde and gold is an interesting lead. Thank you for one more great interview. I would like to ask every listener, if I may, who earns a decent income, to support this site. You also pay for magazines and newspapers and books. Here is one great source on information that we all want to keep having access to. You might not be aware of the fact that a website, when it receives a lot of traffic, will have to pay more to a provider. And as long as we prefer to not have too much or not even any ads and commercials on the site, we have to support it. Well, Lisa, thank you for this comment. And this last part sounds like it could have been a commercial for the show that I wrote myself. But honestly, folks, I didn't do it. It's a totally unsolicited suggestion that you click on that big green donate button. And as for the shadow, you know, I think there's some previous Jungian-type interviews where we got pretty deeply into that topic, but I will keep an eye to cover more coverage on the shadow as we move along. And finally, there's one more, this one from Reinhardt, with a call for a co-facilitator for our Yahoo discussion group. Actually, it was posted on that group, but I thought I should read it aloud here. He writes, "Hi, guys, we have 55 members on our little mailing list now. Woo-hoo! That's the good message. But there's hardly any conversation and traffic there. That's the bad message." And he makes a sign for a grin. "I would like to be more proactive on that list, but I have two problems. One, I live in Austria, and English is not my native language, so it's rather hard for me to write mails without having to concentrate and without considerable effort. And two, more importantly, I'm still in the process of building my life anew, socially, emotionally, work-related, and so on. So my energies are rather tied up in this task. To make a long story short, is anybody willing to be co-moderator here? I think it would be a shame not to use such a great resource of 55 intelligent and well-read and interested people. Maybe the Americans on this list could organize a group gathering or something, just an idea. Or maybe someone has other good ideas, so step up, please. Cheers," and that's from Riney. That's his nickname. He calls himself Riney. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod. And you can leave voicemail also on my message phone at 206-337-0622. And don't forget, you can go to the Apps tab on our site for information about getting our iPhone/iPad/iPod Touch/Android app, and you can contact me directly through that. Thanks to Dr. Stuart Kaplan for his insights into the dangers of diagnosing children with bipolar disorder. My next interview will be with return guest Dr. Elisha Goldstein, and we'll be discussing his new mindfulness book, The Now Effect. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.